MechCast, Wednesday, March 16th, 2016. Hey, Mech Geeks, it's time for your MechCast, the show for Mech Geeks by Mech Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MechCast. Glad to have you back here with me for another episode. Got quite a few things to talk about this week. Apple has finally confirmed their next event. We're going to be talking about what we'll be expecting them to announce next week, along with some rumors and other things surrounding that. We also have updates on the next version of the iPhone. We'll talk about that a little bit and more on the whole FBI encryption, FBI versus Apple encryption debate. We're going to get into that a little bit, mainly in the fact of sort of some of the fallout that's been going on and some things that have been flying back and forth. And then Apple News is getting some new ad formats. So we'll talk about all of that and then get to some of your feedback. A little follow-up on the ransomware thing. I've got some more information on dealing with flaky HomeKit. I got a great little tip for you on moving mail items around in Mail.app. And we're going to finish up talking about DHCP reservations. And then I have an awesome thing of the moment this week for you. So stay tuned for all of that. But before we get into it, I need to take a quick moment and welcome a new sponsor here on the MacCast. I'm really actually excited about telling you about this new sponsor because it's HelloFresh. If you haven't heard of them, HelloFresh is a meal kit delivery service that makes cooking fun, easy, and convenient. The way it works is each week you get a new set of delicious recipes to choose from. From classic, vegetarian, and family meal choices, and then HelloFresh will deliver those to you so that you can make them each week. And they employ a full-time registered dietitian on their staff, so you know that each recipe you get is going to be nutritionally balanced. And they let me try out the service last week, and I can tell you it exceeded my expectations. I knew it was going to be good just based on the recipe choices, but it was fabulous. I got to go on. I got to pick three different meals for the week. They were shipped out and arrived. They came perfectly packaged. They use this special insulated box, and shipping is always free, so it's included. And everything for the meal was in that box inside its own little box. All the little bits and pieces, all of the parts of the recipe that you're going to need. And then the meats and the seafood and everything were packed below on ice, perfectly fresh, perfectly cold. It was amazing. And inside each box too, there's recipe sheets for each meal that you're going to make. So you get step-by-step instructions. They're designed to take about 30 minutes to prepare, and really are written in a way where it doesn't matter if you're an expert or a novice, you're going to be able to make the dish. And all the ingredients are provided in the exact proportions, so you don't have any food waste. And I was completely impressed with the quality. The veggies were fresh and perfect. All the ingredients were really high quality. And best of all, and really what you want, is the end results were delicious. All three meals that we made and ordered were fabulous. We had shrimp risotto, we had chimichurri steak, and this awesome vegetarian dish that was chickpea curry and rice. I can't even tell you. It was great. And then you have the recipe sheets in there, so you can start to build up your own recipe library, and you can remake some of your favorite dishes anytime you want. We're going to be remaking all of these. I'm telling you that right now. So HelloFresh, it's perfect for busy couples. It's families who want to sit down, have meals at home, but maybe don't have the time to do the shopping and for all the prep work. You know, we're all busy. Our schedules get really busy, and sometimes it's hard to make a meal. This allows you to do it. HelloFresh is really for anyone who wants to eat at home more. And it also, for us, it solves the problem of, what are we going to eat this week? The meal planning problem, I call it. And that's a big one at my house. We sit down like trying to plan out meals. Here you go. You look at the meal choices. You pick some really great recipes. And there's a great variety and selection. And you can order 3, 4, or 5 meals per week, and they're designed for either 2 or 4 people. And best of all, here's a deal for you. MacCast listeners can try out HelloFresh and get $35 off their first week of deliveries. So for your $35 off your first week of deliveries, visit HelloFresh.com and then enter MacCast when you subscribe, and you're going to get that big discount on that first week of deliveries. And I think you're going to love this service. It's really great. And a big thanks to HelloFresh for sponsoring the MacCast. Last week, Apple sent out the invites for the rumored press event we thought they were going to hold. And as expected, it is going to be on Monday, March 21st. The official invites went out to the press, and they are calling this the Let Us Loop You In event. That was what was printed on the invites. I'm not going to go and speculate on what that might be, because I think we pretty well know, and we'll get into that. It is going to be live streamed, so I'll be watching it live, and I'm sure we'll have the MacCast IRC chat up and running. If you want to participate on that, just check MacCast.com on Monday, and we should have the information up and available for you. It is going to be held on Apple's campus in Cupertino and starts at 10 a.m. Pacific time. What's expected to be announced is the iPhone SE, or what some people are calling the special edition, or maybe even small edition, because it's going to be the 4-inch version of the iPhone. It has basically iPhone 6S-like specifications. So you've got the A9 processor in there, NFC and Apple Pay support, a metal casing with curved edges. So it's going to be the same dimensions and size as the current 5S, but sporting more of an iPhone 6S-like look. The ports and buttons, though, are still going to be configured just like they are on the iPhone 5S. And some people have speculated about Apple removing the headphone jack. That's not going to happen in this one. That's for the iPhone 7. And pricing is expected to start at around $400 to $500 US. And it's likely going to come in a 16 gigabyte and a 64 gigabyte storage option. So it's really going to be priced to kind of replace the current position of the iPhone 5S. It is expected that the iPhone 5S may stay around as the lower priced option, and maybe more specifically in some of Apple's emerging markets like India and China. And that is something that Gene Munster seems to think Apple might be doing. And I think that makes a lot of sense. Now, the other thing that's expected to be announced at this event is the next version of the iPad Air. It's sounding, though, it's like it might be being marketed as the iPad Pro 7.9-inch version. So Apple may drop the iPad Air moniker at this launch and simply go with iPad Pro for the larger iPad lineup. So you'd have iPad Mini and then an iPad Pro 9.7, an iPad Pro 12-inch model. Now, some leaked case designs seem to confirm a lot of what we already think we know, that the device will have an opening for the smart connector. It will have an LED flash and quad stereo speakers. Would be the first iPad to have a flash. And that sort of hints at Apple recognizing that a lot of people, specifically with the iPad Mini and the 9.7-inch iPad, do take photos with that. So wanting to be able to take a little bit better photos, having that flash option in there. It's supposed to have the faster A9X processor and may come with 4 gigabytes of RAM, just like the larger Pro model. And it would have Apple Pencil and, of course, smart keyboard support, because it would have that connector. And it is expected that Apple would also announce a new, smaller, you know, appropriately sized version of the smart keyboard along with the 9.7-inch iPad Pro. And pricing is expected to start at around $499 for the 16 gigabyte Wi-Fi model. So lining up right with the iPad Air, the current iPad Air pricing specs. The couple other items that are expected to be announced at this event are new Apple Watch bands and maybe some pre-configured combinations of Apple Watch featuring some of the new band options. Not a lot of specifics on what the bands are going to be, although there has been a hint that Apple may do a Space Black Melanie's Loop version of the Melanie's Loop band. So that should look very nice. We should also expect probably that Apple will have the iOS, watchOS, and tvOS updates come out as well. They may come out a few days before, although Apple's announcing earlier in the week than they normally do. Usually it's a Tuesday or a Wednesday, so it might be the fact that they're coming out on Monday that they announced the OS shipping the same day. Apple's been shipping betas very quickly. As a matter of fact, this last week they shipped iOS beta 9.3 beta 7 just about a week after they shipped 6, and 6 came out just a week after they shipped beta 5. So Apple's been really stepping that up. It seems like they're getting ready to roll those out to the public. And along with the announcement of new iPads and iPhones, that would seem to be pretty good timing to do that. Another thing that could happen, probably not going to be announced at the event, but MacBook Pros and MacBooks are kind of overdue for an update. The MacBook Pros and the 12-inch MacBook Skylake processors are out, and a lot of people have been waiting to upgrade their MacBook Pros, for example, for when Apple updates to Skylake. That could happen along with this announcement, although I would expect it to be something that Apple just sort of quietly rolls out on their website. We haven't heard a lot of details around that, so I would expect it to mainly be an internal specification update, and, you know, just kind of updating the processors. Don't expect them to update much more, and the design of the MacBook Pros and MacBook should remain largely the same. I don't think there's going to be any big surprises there. Products announced during the event will possibly be available to order at the end of the week, the same week, or maybe the next week. So there shouldn't be a long delay before you'll be able to order the iPhone SE or the iPad Pro or pick up those new Apple Watch bands. Should happen pretty quickly. And then I think I've mentioned a little bit my theory that one of the reasons that Apple is bringing out a new version of the iPhone sort of off cycle. So normally we have our iPhone updates in the fall. Now we're getting this sort of spring update of this new model. One of the reasons I think Apple is doing that is to kind of counteract slowing iPhone sales. We know from the last quarterly results call and from some of the speculation on what the iPhone numbers are going to look like this quarter, that sales seem to be slowing a little bit. And it seems like a good plan to bring out a new model to kind of counteract that little slump. And while we do know the numbers are slowing, it might not be as bad as some think. The latest China sales numbers from Kantar World Panel Comtech are still showing growth in China for Apple, but at a slightly slower rate. The numbers covered a three-month period ending in January and showed that iOS had about a 25% market share in China. That grew from 19% in the three-month period ending in September of 2015 and was up to over 27% in the three-month period ending in December. So in December, the prior three-month period, growth had gone to 27%. It's about 25% for this current last three-month period. But they did note that January was the weakest month for iPhone sales in China. But that might be to some consumers simply waiting for some Chinese New Year's deals that typically happen in February. But regardless, Apple is kind of seeing, again, that slower sales growth. And I think the timing of this event, specifically the 4-inch iPhone launch, is very geared to kind of counteract what's been going on. But again, we'll be covering here on the MacCast all of the announcements that happen on Monday. So expect an updated episode next week. And again, if you'd like to join us live in the IRC chat, just check maccast.com on Monday morning and we should have all the details for you so you can come hang out with us. A bunch of us hang out and just sort of chat back and forth as the event is being live streamed. What's going to happen with the next version of the iPhone 7 in the fall? We've been getting a lot of details and leaks, and this week we're starting to see actually some images. As a matter of fact, the French blog Nowhere Else posted what was supposedly a leaked rear case for an actual iPhone 7, and in it, it showed a reduced camera bump. There had been some theories that Apple might finally get rid of the camera bump completely, but here it's just a little bit more subtle. It's almost kind of just like a beveled edge, unlike the current models where the lens seems to be just kind of sitting on top. This is more fused or worked into the actual case design, and the rear camera hole does appear to be a little bit larger, which sort of seems to indicate that Apple may have some new camera technology in there. Another thing that seems to be coming true, based on, at least on this image, is that the antenna lines are less pronounced. They're up a little bit closer to the edge of the device, so not so far offset. And the line across the middle has been removed. So you don't have that long line across the middle. It just kind of goes up and around the top and bottom edges of the phone. The same French blog also posted alleged pictures of the dual lens component that many think is going to be in the iPhone 7 Plus. That same component surfaced back in January as well. As far as what that dual lens technology is, this is stuff that Apple acquired when it picked up Linux imaging. And it's expected that there will be two lenses potentially in some of the iPhone models. A lot of people are thinking it's going to be limited to the iPhone 7 Plus. And what you have is a wide angle lens and a 2 to 3x optical zoom lens sitting side by side. And then they can both take images, and within software, Apple would be able to do a number of different things, combining the data from multiple sensors to give images more clarity, more depth, more color detail. And it is said to be technology that can really enhance images, especially in low light situations, something that a lot of digital images suffer from. And I've seen some of the sample pictures from the Linux technology, and it does look pretty amazing, the kinds of stuff you can do. There's also the potential to do things like after the fact adaptive focus, kind of like the Lytro systems. So you can actually take an image and adjust the focus. So if you took an image and it had focused on something close, but you would have rather it have focused on something further away, because that image data was captured, you can just simply tap on the image and readjust the focus. Pretty amazing stuff. And hopefully that turns out to be true, that this does get worked into the next generation iPhone. Another Chinese site supposedly posted the first images of the entire iPhone 7 Plus. Again, it showed the reduced camera bump, although in that model, it had a pill-shaped opening, sort of an oval-shaped opening for the camera housing that had the dual lenses in it. It also did have the minimized antenna lines along the top and bottom. But interestingly, that image also showed what looked like a smart connector on the back of the iPhone, something that we hadn't heard rumored before, that it might get a smart connector. Now, the positioning of it seems a little bit odd because it's not along an edge, so I don't know that there would be like a keyboard accessory that might be able to dock in there. And so far, that's what Apple's used it for, at least with the iPads. So I'm not sure how that would attach. A lot of these leaked images, there was another set of them that showed a front and bottom of what they claimed to be an iPhone 7. And as expected there was no headphone jack. But interestingly, looking at the front, it was also missing a home button. Now, there's been a lot of speculation for years that Apple's been toying with eliminating the home button on the device. And in case you're wondering, well, if they take away the home button, what about things like Touch ID? The report said that Apple has technology where Touch ID is integrated into the display. And that's actually something we've seen hinted at in some of Apple's patent filings. Whether or not that technology is ready to go and would be here for an iPhone 7 model, that seems a little bit iffy. And I still am in the camp that I don't think Apple's ready to get rid of the home button quite yet. So what's going on here? You know, there's a lot of kind of weird new things coming out with these iPhone 7 image leaks. The iPhone modding company Feld & Volk said that based on their research, both the iPhone 7 and the iPhone 7 Plus may include that dual camera lens system. And that's pretty good news because prior rumors had said it was just going to be the one model. And I'm not a big fan, as you know, of the plus-sized phones. But I really would like to get that dual camera lens technology in my device. So Feld and Volk have been accurate with their rumors in the past, so I'm really hoping this one will come true. And it is still believed that Apple will drop that headphone connector on the 7 Series devices and simply go with a Lightning connector and Bluetooth connections. The big question is going to be, will they include a Lightning to a 3.5 millimeter adapter in the box, or is that going to be an additional purchased accessory? I think it's going to be the latter. I think you're not going to get one in the box. If you want to hook up your old headphones and do it through the old analog jack, you're going to have to buy the adapter from Apple. And I'm guessing the price would be around $20. But I have no confirmation on that. That's purely my own speculation. We also got a new rumor this week that the Plus model may get an additional storage option up to 256 gigabytes on the top end. And the justification for this rumor is that there is a 256 gigabyte NAND flash module being produced by SanDisk now, and it's actually smaller than the current 64 gigabyte module that Apple uses, and that could allow for a thinner design with more storage. And we had been hearing that the iPhone 7 could be as thin as 6.1 millimeters, basically the same thickness as the current iPod Touch. And Apple Insider seems to doubt the rumor, but they do speculate that if it is true, Apple could introduce the iPhone 7 Plus in sizes of 64 gigabyte, 128 gigabyte, and 256 gigabytes, sticking with three size choices rather than bumping to four. To me, though, it seems more likely that they would do 32, 128, and 256. Apple, classically has gotten rid of kind of that middle tier. They always go with the lowest. So in the past, it's been 16, 64, 128. I would think they'd go to 32, 128, 256 if they end up going to 256 at all. I know a lot of people out there that would really like that. I'm kind of giving this rumor, not a really good chance. I don't see Apple thinking that they have to put that much storage in an iPhone, but I'd love to be proven wrong. And personally, I feel as far as, these leak images and the rumors that are going on right now, any of them that you're hearing are speculative at best. I really don't think Apple has moved into production. So the fact that we're seeing fully assembled or even partial, backplate components and things for an iPhone 7 or an iPhone 7 Plus seems a little bit strange. They really are likely pre-production models or prototype models, just things that Apple are producing for spec designs. And this is something that we know Apple does. They try a bunch of different options and different concepts out during the prototype phases. They change the designs, they switch up the specs, all the way up to the final minutes of going into production on the actual model. So they're trying to figure out what's going to work, what's not going to work. So the idea of a smart connector has not been proposed before, but it could be interesting. But is it really going to work out? Who really knows? Is it something that's going to provide some sort of benefit? But it certainly does give credit to the idea that Apple might be considering, we had heard this rumor, they might be considering an additional iPhone design, an iPhone 7 Pro. And typically that smart connector has been going along with the iPad Pro. So maybe that's what's going on there. But really, at this point, I think we can't read too much into these rumors. As it gets closer to that September-October timeframe, we'll start to see these things solidify. But really, sitting here in March, it's a bit early, but still fun to speculate on. This fight between the FBI and Apple over encryption and privacy is really heating up, and it seems to be having some halo effects in heightening the encryption debate that's going on right now. A lot of the fallout seems to continue with companies, governments, and agencies on both sides pushing legislation and technology and really just making statements and comments that are an attempt to give their side an edge, possibly even in future fights. And a lot of the comments that are being thrown around, at least around this case, are about kind of saying, hey, if this case goes one way or another, you can expect this sort of result to happen or this kind of legislation to come forward in the future. And in case you're wondering what that future might look like, over in the UK, they've got this investigatory powers bill going on that is doing exactly what the US government is saying they might have to do if Apple successfully fights this court order in this San Bernardino iPhone case. There's currently a draft in Parliament, and this bill in the UK is only a draft at this point. It's not quite law, but in it, there's language that would give state agencies the power to compel companies to build software in ways that would enable the government to essentially hack devices. This includes communication service providers, what they call CSPs over there, and these are basically internet and phone companies. It's basically saying, hey, you have to give us a way to wiretap, get at this information, get at this data. I also think it sets up some requirements, or it's my understanding it sets up some requirements for them to actually gather and store data on customers. So all of the traffic logs for customers as they're surfing the web and browsing websites, also call records and data and information, and they're being required to keep that for an extended length of time. And right now, the UK government seems to want to get the legislation through Parliament before the end of the year. And the concern is that that doesn't leave a lot of time for review or scrutiny of the proposed changes to this law. Now, the Security and Intelligence Committee and other government committees who looked at an earlier version of this proposal of the legislation, they expressed concerns that it was too broad, that it didn't account enough for privacy protections of people in the UK, of citizens in the UK. And they say that these current revisions that are trying to go through, they really don't address any of these concerns. And so, you know, this is the kind of thing where they're saying, basically, we're going to mandate that technologies and companies have to have backdoors. They have to have ways for us to get at information when we request it. And you're going to be forced to do that sort of thing. And the government seems to be posturing that things could get a lot worse for Apple in this fight if they continue to not comply with this court order. And so this could be a little sign of where our legislation goes in the future. And it's concerning in the UK, and it's also concerning over here. The DOJ filed a response with a warning that made it sound like they considered filing for an order that would have compelled Apple to turn over the iOS source code directly to them along with the signing keys so that the FBI could basically write the hack that they're asking Apple to do, or the modification to the operating system that they're asking Apple to do themselves. But they said they didn't because, quote, such a request would be less palatable to Apple. But in that statement, they were basically implying, hey, Apple, we could have made this worse on you and we didn't. So, you know, be careful. And then President Obama, he was at South by Southwest this week, and he warned of what might happen if a battle ensues between tech companies and the government over encryption. Now, he didn't specifically call out Apple, but he said, quote, what will happen is if everybody goes to their respective corners and the tech community says, either we have strong, perfect encryption or else it's Big Brother and an Orwellian world, what you'll find is that after something really bad happens, the politics of this will swing and it will become sloppy and rushed, and it will go through Congress in ways that are dangerous and not thought through. So he seems to be basically implying that if companies take steps to ensure encryption is so strong that they can't be compelled to let the government in, then the government would be forced to mandate something or might push something through Congress, kind of like what's happening over in the UK, might try to push something through that would mandate that companies have to build in backdoors, basically, you know, telling companies how they have to write their software. Now, Republican Congressman Daryl Issa called the comments by the president, quote, tone deaf with regards to the technology involved, saying he just really doesn't understand the technology that, you know, just like most security experts, or I think almost all security experts that I've heard talk about this, say there is no way to create a special key just for the U.S. government and law enforcement. If you make this backdoor, if you make a way to break in, then other people, foreign governments, criminals, those sorts of people who want to steal people's private data and information, they're going to find their way in as well. So, you know, the debate is definitely heating up, and it seems to be moving to this sort of doomsday scenario being generated from both sides. You know, the government saying, if we don't have this, all of Americans are going to be less secure and terrorism is going to run rampant. And then the technology companies on the other side saying, hey, if you make us do this, then everybody's going to be less secure, our privacy is going to be compromised, and it's going to be bad. Another thing that is happening is that tech companies are starting to rally and try and sort of wall themselves or reinforce the technologies that they currently have to make it so that future orders like this would literally not be able to be processed by them. The Wall Street Journal is reporting that Apple is making plans to secure iCloud data now in a way where they would no longer have the encryption keys for the data that they store, meaning that they wouldn't be able to do things like decrypt the iCloud backups, which is something that they did for the FBI in the San Bernardino case. Now, if you remember, part of the problem is the backups that Apple had in their possession didn't go all the way through and up to the time of the event in December. They stopped in October. So the FBI is trying to get at some additional data. But as previously mentioned, Apple can currently decrypt iCloud data and backups that are stored on their servers when they're presented with a valid warrant. And they have done this before, and that's because they hold the encryption keys to that data. And we talked about this on a previous MacCast, why that is. It's sort of a customer service thing. The idea is that if you forget your iCloud password and you need to get out your backups, Apple still has the ability to help their customers do that. So it's kind of a customer service thing. And Apple treats that a little bit differently than the data on that's actually physically on the device, on the iPhone, where they feel it's more important that be locked down in case someone steals your iPhone gets into the wrong hands. You want to make sure that the data that's actually on the device is protected. Now, if they change that, then Apple would no longer be able to decrypt the data that was in iCloud, even if they were presented with a warrant. There are currently some things actually in the iCloud data that work like this. Your iCloud keychain data is actually encrypted locally before it is backed up. So Apple already encrypts it in that way. So this looks like they're just planning to kind of expand that same technique to all of the iCloud data. And it sounds like the basic idea is that Apple would combine their encryption key for iCloud with a passcode or a user password or passphrase that you would set, so Apple wouldn't have that part of the key. They'd put those two things together, use that to encrypt the data, and then Apple would not have access to the data outside the authentication process. So that would allow Apple, when you go to, say, iCloud.com, you'd have to put in your passcode to kind of decrypt or unlock that data if you wanted to get access to it. And presumably, Apple wouldn't store that passphrase or that password at all. They'd just throw it away and only use it for allowing you to get access to your data. And in that way, if the government came knocking, they could say, you know, we don't know. We cannot get at this data because we don't have that passphrase. Of course, the disadvantage to this change for customers is that if you forget your iCloud password or that passcode, rather, for that encrypted data, then it would be impossible for Apple to help you recover that, and you wouldn't be able to get your data back. This is something that Apple currently can do, and it does come up from time to time in cases where, say, a family member has died and the family wants to be able to transfer that data or get at those data backups. When presented, I think, with a death certificate, Apple can help customers sort of get at that information. So they kind of keep that really, you know, closed, but it's sounding like it may change. And this is all in response to what's going on in this Apple versus FBI case. So a lot of posturing, a lot of new technologies being considered and potentially developed to kind of deal with the whole situation that's going on here. And it's certainly going to be going on for a lot longer, the whole appeals process going through. And right now it's getting a little bit nasty, if you ask me. I mean, both sides kind of really walling up and calling names and sort of pointing fingers at each other, as often happens in these cases. I kind of don't like even talking about it too much, but it's certainly something Apple is embroiled in, and we're going to be talking about it for some time to come. If you have any of your own thoughts and comments on it, I would welcome those, especially audio comments. Just, you know, a brief couple minute audio comment on your thoughts. Shoot those to maccast@gmail.com. And then finally, in the news for this week, a bit of news about Apple's news app. Apple has updated the support document for ads, or the ad specifications for iAd, and it looks like they have a new format for ads within that could be displayed within the news app called the news ad format. It's actually in the native banner section, and it seems to now allow for feeds to have sponsored ad content. And these are like many of the ads you might see when you go to websites. Like, I've seen them on yahoo.com, my Yahoo homepage, and these are ads that actually look like articles. I am not a big fan of these. All you get is a little small line of text that says sponsored by, and it's very often hard to tell the difference between the actual article and the actual ad anymore. But it's sounding like the news app is going to allow for these for providers who want to insert them. Of course, any provider has the option to decide what kind of ads they want to include with their content, and some include no ads at all. So it's really going to be up to the person supplying the content to Apple. But something that also happened this week with regard to the news app is Apple opened up the Apple News service to just about everybody, small publishers, individual bloggers, anybody who wants to publish news into the news app can do so now. Prior to this week, Apple had allowed publishers to submit their feeds, but they were actually approving or hand approving only a select few publishers. So everything you've seen in the news app to date has sort of been vetted by Apple. Now they're opening it up. I think they're still going to have somewhat of a vetting process to make sure, you know, it is a news service or a small publishing service or a blog or something like that. I mean, you have to be publishing news, but beyond that, they're kind of opening the floodgates. And so we'll have to see how that happens. But certainly generating ad revenue and opening up the platform is going to bring more publications on board and potentially more eyeballs to Apple's news app. And that's good for Apple. It'll be interesting just to see how the ads play out. But I'm kind of curious too, do you use the news app regularly, and what do you think about it? I didn't use it very much, but I've been using it a little bit more lately, and I think I find it pretty good for when I just want to browse through what's happening. Sort of, you know, Sunday morning, sitting down with a cup of coffee, almost, you know, that experience of reading through the newspaper. I kind of treat it like a tailored digital newspaper or magazine, and I'm finding it pretty interesting. Although I think the most frustrating thing that I find is that some feeds tend to not offer full versions of their articles. So that really kills the Apple News experience for me. You click on the article title and you just get a brief one paragraph, and then you still have to click through and go to the website. And I can't remember if it opens in Safari or in Safari right in the app, but still it kind of breaks you out of that news reading experience. It doesn't feel all encompassing. So I kind of wish there was a way to filter out and identify any of the providers that aren't providing full feeds, and so I could just take them out. But I've just been taking them out by hand. And the other thing about the news app for me is it really doesn't and really can't replace my dedicated RSS readers when I'm trying to just go for targeted news. So if I want just my Apple News and I want to drill in there, I know that the news app kind of has categories, but really I find it, you know, its experience is better for discovery, where you have kind of all your feeds or different kind of categories coming in. So I have, you know, like tech and some arts stuff, and I think a couple different categories of things that I like, TV and movies, entertainment, that kind of stuff. And I have it all coming into one feed, some world news, some local news, that kind of stuff. And it's neat to have it all kind of mixed together because it does kind of more recreate that newspaper experience. So that's kind of how I'm feeling about Apple News and using it. How are you using it? Shoot me some feedback. MacCast@gmail.com. So I want to follow up a little bit on a couple of the things we talked about last week. I brought up the Apple story about that ransomware that had surfaced, and I gave some tips on how you could potentially protect yourself better against ransomware. And I received an email from Jill, who had some pretty good feedback and pointed out that I didn't talk about one way to protect against malware and ransomware is to simply tighten down the gatekeeper restrictions on your Mac and allow only apps from the Mac App Store to be installed. And while this isn't 100% guarantee that you won't get any malware or ransomware, it will severely limit your exposure to that because you won't be allowed to install anything from outside the Mac App Store, and the Mac App Store stuff is generally vetted and you know, it's gone through a process from Apple. So if you wanted to do this, you'd go into System Preferences, you'd go into Security and Privacy, and then you would set the Allow Apps Downloaded From option to Mac App Store only. And you might be going, well, that's a little bit inconvenient because I do have apps that I want to install from outside the App Store. Well, there's actually a pretty simple way, at least one off, to allow that. So what this does to help protect you against malware and ransomware is if you were to get something that tried to install itself, which is typically how these things work. So you'll get a Trojan app that you install on purpose, and then within that, there's some sort of thing that tries to install itself. It's going to not allow that to happen. But for things that you do want to download from outside the Mac App Store and install yourself, if you just simply hold down command click on the installer or right click on the installer and choose open, then that kind of is a signal to Gatekeeper that says, hey, I know I'm working outside your rules, but I really want to open up this app or I really want to install this app. And it will just confirm, hey, you know, are you sure you're doing this in violation of the Gatekeeper settings? Do you want to install this? You say okay, and then it will let it go forward. So you can kind of temporarily override that Gatekeeper setting. Another option would be also to just jump back into System Preferences, set the Gatekeeper preferences down one notch so that you can install a third-party app from outside the App Store, install it, and then flip it back on. Now, of course, if you do that, you're bypassing that advantage of, you know, sort of blocking any potential ransomware or malware, but at least you're doing it knowingly. It can't just happen automatically in the background without you being aware of it. So I thought that was a pretty good mention from Jill. And then she also pointed out that my little checksum trick that I talked about in that show was potentially not good advice because if a hacker had the ability to replace the installer file that was on a website, which was what happened in the case of Transmission, then they would have access to go in and just change the checksum number on the page. What was interesting and what I pointed out last week was that this hacker didn't do that. So while true, it's not 100% certainty that they would have updated the checksum as well. And if they didn't, you would still get a failure when you tried to check the installer versus the checksum on the website. And at least that would be kind of a heads up, hey, something fishy is going on here. But you're right, you probably can't rely on it with 100% certainty as being, I'm in the clear, I can go ahead and install this. So a very valid point. You know, as always, we just have to be aware of what we're installing on our system, where we're getting it from. Unfortunately, in this case, if it's a hacked website, you might be thinking you're getting it from a legitimate source and you're still getting something bad. So, you know, Jill's earlier point of maybe strengthening Gatekeeper is another way to protect yourself. And then I also gave you a couple of their monitoring tools that you could run, things like Little Snitch and the like that will alert you if there's weird stuff going on, weird things being installed, or weird network activity going on. And that's probably the best way to kind of, you know, protect yourself. You're not going to catch it, you know, before you install it, but at least you'll be aware when something fishy starts happening. Another thing we did last week was try and help out Matt with some HomeKit issues. And in that segment, I mentioned that HomeKit was, in some ways, to coin a Steve Jobsism, a bag of hurt. If anybody has anybody who has dealt with HomeKit knows that it can be finicky, that some hubs will give you trouble. My Insteon hub, for example, will sometimes respond to a Siri command as if it worked when it didn't. So it'll report back, hey, the lights are now on, while I'm sitting in a completely dark room. And I know fully well that it hasn't turned the lights on. And it can be infuriating. It can be frustrating. And Matt was having some trouble with his HomeKit setup and had asked us about that. So I had mentioned a few ways you could try and fix it or deal with it, including making sure you've updated the firmware on your hub, turning hubs on and off again, rebooting iOS devices, you know, all kinds of different fixes. But Matt emailed back to let me know he resolved his own issue, and it actually had not so much, didn't have anything to do with HomeKit, or at least not anything directly related to HomeKit. One of the things I had tried, had suggested trying, was going into the settings, selecting the HomeKit, which is typically home, you know, your home HomeKit network, and then turning off remote access. And the reason I was doing that is one of the things is that HomeKit, if you have an Apple TV, third generation Apple TV or better, it can, you know, let you get HomeKit information or control your HomeKit devices when you're outside your home network. And Matt seemed to be having issues in his internal home network. And one thought was, well, maybe it's trying to go out to the internet and sort of loop back in. So if we turn that off, maybe it'll restrict HomeKit to stay on the home network and not try to do that. And when Matt tried to follow that tip, he kept getting an error when he tried to turn off remote access, or turn on remote access rather, because it was already off. It said, can't configure this option, please try again. And he just on a whim thought, well, let me turn off the Wi-Fi and try doing it on LTE. And when the LTE was the only option, the switch was turned on. And if he would change it back to Wi-Fi, it would go back off again. So that got him thinking, well, maybe this is a Wi-Fi issue. And he ended up testing on LTE, and everything on HomeKit worked flawlessly. So he could give the Siri command, he could do everything. So he thought, well, maybe my issue isn't HomeKit at all, it's actually my Wi-Fi network. And sure enough, resetting his network settings and rebooting the router cleared everything right up. So the tip would be, hey, if you're having some HomeKit issues, check your home network and make sure that's not part of the problem. And I think it goes, you know, back through to the whole remote access thing as well. Maybe having a remote access on or off will make a difference, and it's worth playing around with those settings. So a little bit of follow-up there. And then Gary wrote in with another kind of HomeKit question about some of the complexity of each, you know, that each kind of HomeKit device brings, because very often when you buy a device, be it from iDevices or Elgato or Ecobee or Philips, each one of those things has its own hub that you got to hook into your network, along with its own app. And Gary's kind of question is, do you really need all of these apps and all this complexity in the system? And I'll tell you, Gary, there isn't much you can do on the hub front. Generally, you do have to hook up the hub that goes along with your device, which I think just overall complicates your network setup. Though you could use something like HomeBridge, which is, you know, I've been talking about that project for a while. It's software you can actually run on your Mac or on a Raspberry Pi or some other platforms that will act like a HomeKit bridge. And it'll even let you add to your HomeKit network some devices that don't have native HomeKit support. But it requires that a plugin has been written for your HomeKit devices. So if there is one for that, you might be able to simplify using HomeBridge. But in general, you're just going to connect the hub that came with your device, and that's the one that's going to work best and offer, I think, the most functionality. So not much you can do to get around that. But as far as having one app to control everything, you absolutely can do that. Now, with a small caveat, you might have to set up and register your devices with your HomeKit network using their own app. I think that's generally the easiest way to do it. Each one kind of has its own little process, whether it's, you know, pointing at a QR code or entering in a serial number or a code number off the device. But once it's registered and has been added to your HomeKit network, any app that is HomeKit compatible should be able to see all of those devices. And you can confirm this by, you know, downloading a third-party HomeKit app and running it, and you'll see that you'll see all of your hubs and all of your devices and all of your scenes and rooms and zones and all of that stuff will show up in each of the apps. So you could use a third-party app that doesn't have any association with any kind of devices like Home for iOS. And I'll have links to these in the show notes at maccast.com. And that's what a lot of people do. A lot of people really like the Home app for iOS. It kind of feels like the app that Apple should have written, and why Apple hasn't done their own HomeKit app is baffling to me. But then you could also use a single app from a single provider, like, for example, Elgato's Eve app, or even Insteon's Insteon Plus app. I personally like the Elgato Eve app. That's the one I've been using most frequently. I just like the UI. I like the look of it even more than the Home app, although the Home app is very good. And again, in each app, you're going to see your zones and rooms and scenes, and you can create those in each app as well. So you just kind of find the one HomeKit app that you really like and just use that to configure and control all of your HomeKit devices. And that does simplify things quite a bit. But like I said, you may have to install the app that came with your device, at least initially, to just get it added to the HomeKit network. But after that, you know, really, if you use Siri voice commands to control everything, you don't even directly interface with the app at all. And maybe that's what Apple was thinking in terms of, you know, not writing an actual kind of HomeKit application from Apple, is that most people are probably going to use Siri voice commands, and there really is, you know, a built-in UI for that on every iOS device. So that's a little bit about HomeKit, a little bit of follow-up to what we were talking about last week. Now I have for you a couple of cool mail tips. If you're a mail.app user on your Mac, if you use Apple's built-in mail client, you might find these little tips handy for specifically accessing key mailboxes and moving messages between them. A lot of people don't know that there is a favorites bar in the Mail app that works a lot like the bookmark bar in Safari. So under the toolbar, you get this little line, and you can put in there your frequently used mailboxes. If you don't see it, go under the View menu, and you'll see a Show Favorites bar option. The keyboard shortcut is Command-Option-Shift-H. And then you'll get that little bar there. And if you want to add any mailbox or folder into that Favorites bar, all you have to do is simply drag it up into the bar. And then once it's in the bar, you can click on any one of those to access them quickly. And if it's a folder, it'll even give you a drop-down so that you can drill down into any sub-mailboxes or subfolders that might be in there. And what's cool about putting them into the favorites bar is that the first 9 items going from left to right will actually get a default shortcut keyboard shortcut assigned to them. So if you hold the command key and then press the number where the number is the position left to right in the favorites bar. So the first item in the favorites bar is number 1, the second number 2, and so on. If you hit command plus the number of the item you want to access, it will jump right to that folder in mail. So command plus 3, for example, will take you to the third mailbox that you have put into your favorites bar. And you can reorder them by simply dragging them around in the favorites bar, and that will change, obviously, the keyboard shortcut that's assigned to them automatically. And what's even cooler is once they're in there, If you want to move any messages from any other mailbox or folder to those locations, there's actually a keyboard shortcut for that as well. Of course, you could just simply drag a message or a group of messages directly onto the favorites item in the bar, and that will move it to that folder. And those folders are even spring-loaded, or those favorite items are even spring-loaded. So if you hold it up there and you hover, and it has an additional drop-down, it will drop down automatically, and you can move it into a subfolder or a sub-mailbox. There's also actually a menu item for mail under the mailbox menu. There's a move to favorite mailbox option, and if you go in there, you'll see a list. So you could select the item in the mail application that you want to move and then use the menu items. But probably the fastest way to actually move it is to just use the keyboard shortcuts. So under that move to favorite mailbox menu item, you'll notice the keyboard shortcuts there, and they're simply command plus control plus the number of the mailbox in the favorites bar. So again, command control 3, while you have an item selected anywhere in mail, will actually move that item or that message to that favorite mailbox. And you can save a lot of time in moving messages, especially if you have certain mailboxes that you're always, you know, filing messages away to. And I have a few of those. So just put those as one of the first 9 items in your favorites bar, and you'll have these handy little shortcuts to help you along. Now, you are somewhat limited because you can only get 9 in there, and then after that, you'll have to still go fall back on the drag and drop or using the menu items option. But if you need even more scripting for moving or copying messages around, you could use a tool like Alfred, which is a great piece of software that lets you automate and script tons of stuff on your Mac using keyboard shortcuts. And the cool thing about Alfred is that people can program and write their own actions and workflows. And there's actually an Alfred Mail Actions workflow that you can download and install. Now, I will mention that it looks like this workflow or these actions haven't been updated in about 2 years. So I'm not 100% positive that they'll still work with Alfred and the current version of Mail, but the source code for the action workflow is on GitHub. So if you have an issue, you could likely get in there and modify the script and recompile it, but it's at least worth looking into. And maybe there is another set of actions that are more current than these. If you happen to know about those, let me know. But it looked like the perfect way, because you could just, in a couple quick shortcuts, really move or copy messages from any one mailbox to any other mailbox in Mail using these actions in Alfred. And that's just another way to go. But the keyboard shortcut tips are a great place to start. And so I wanted to share those with you in this episode. Let's talk a little bit about networking and networking issues more specifically. I think if you've owned your Mac for any amount of time and you have multiple Macs and multiple devices on your home network, you've probably hit the situation where you suddenly notice that your Mac's network name gets changed and there's a little number after it. So it's got the name and then a parentheses and a little number after the name. Or maybe you've come home, you're coming back home after work or from being on vacation, you hook up to your home network, and you get this message that says, another device on the network is using your computer's IP address. And you're going, oh man, what happened? Did I get hacked? What's going on here? Why am I getting this message? Why am I having these weird network issues? Why is it thinking there's more than one of my computer on my network? I only have one of them. What's going on? And what typically happens here is it's often caused because of the dynamic host configuration protocol, the DHCP service that's in your router. And basically what's happening is it's reassigning an IP address to your computer that was in use by another computer, sometimes your own computer, because it's cached it or, you know, kept it on the network somewhere, and now it's attempting to reassign it, and it thinks for some reason that there's two of the same IP address on your network. And the typical fix for this is to simply just reset the router. You reboot the router and then it'll kind of fix itself. And go back and assign IP addresses to each Mac or device on your network, and hopefully we'll avoid the conflict. And that's okay, but not necessarily convenient. Another way around this problem is to turn off DHCP on your router altogether and actually manually assign IP addresses to each computer and device on your network. But that's time consuming, it's technical, and what happens if you just want to plug in a new device and have it get an IP address from the network, or maybe you have a guest over and you want to allow them on your home network and give them your password? You know, you're going to have to go in and manually configure their IP address, and you know, who wants to do that? So what I wanted to share with you is something that I've been using for a while that I think has really helped kind of get rid of a lot of issues on my home network and lets you have the best of both worlds of having basically static IPs on all of the devices on your home network, but also allowing for the DHCP service to still work when you add additional devices or temporary devices or want to add other devices and you don't want to assign them an IP address. And it's something called DHCP reservations. And I've talked about it from time to time in the past on the MacCast, and I even did a members episode on it. And I want to share with you kind of what was covered in that members episode years ago, because I think these are really handy. So a DHCP reservation is basically a way to assign the same IP address to the same computer or device from the DHCP server. So you let the DHCP server go, hey, I know you, you're that device, and this is your address. I've sort of held this address aside. I won't give it to any other computer or device but you. And that avoids this conflict problem because that device can never be assigned a different IP address. And this is something that's supported by Apple's AirPort Extremes. It's supported on Macs and iOS devices and also third-party routers. And you can use it. And the basic way it works is you need to know a unique ID for each device on your network. And luckily, every device out of the box has something called a MAC address. And that's not Apple Mac. It's just it's a unique number address that's given to the network card, either the Ethernet card or the AirPort card in your Mac or iOS device or any device that has a network connection. And it is totally unique to that device. It will never be duplicated. So it's really an ID for that device. Another thing that you can do is you can actually assign what's called a DHCP client ID. And that would be an identifier that you assign yourself. And you can do that directly on your devices. And you can use either the MAC address or the DHCP client ID to set up the DHCP reservation on your router. So, and like I said, the MAC address, that's something that you can simply find. The DHCP client ID you actually have to assign, and it's pretty easy to do. On a Mac, you go into System Preferences, you go into the Network Preferences, and you choose the interface that you want to assign the ID to. So be it the Ethernet port or the AirPort, whatever that is, you select that item, and then you click on the Advanced button. And then what you want to do is to set the configure using DHCP in the TCP IP tab of the advanced interface there. And inside there, you'll see this little box that says DHCP client ID. And in there, you set the ID to whatever you want. And it's just a text string. I don't think you can have any spaces, but you can have dashes. I'm not sure about underscores, but basically you give it a unique name. So I will typically do something like, oh, I don't know, MacBook Pro dash Ethernet, MacBook Pro dash AirPort. And the key is that you're going to need to remember that. If you want to use the client ID for your DHCP reservations, you need to remember that for later, because that's what you're going to configure in the router. On iOS, it's a similar process. You go into Settings, General, Network. You select the network that you want to assign the DHCP client ID to. And then under DHCP, there is a client ID field. And you just fill that in. So again, I would say like, you know, iPhone or Adam's iPhone or whatever that is. The key is you just need to make sure that it is unique for each device that you assign a DHCP client ID to. If you'd prefer just to use the MAC address, the Media Access Control address, that's what MAC stands for. And this is a number consisting of six groups of two digits separated by a colon, and they're hexadecimal digits. So there can be some letters in there. And for any network device, or more specifically interface, you have one of these. So to figure out what yours are, because again, you're going to need to use it to plug into the configuration on your router. On the Mac, you go into System Preferences, Network, you select the interface, Ethernet or Airport, and then click on the Ethernet tab. And within that tab, you note what's called the Ethernet ID if you're using Ethernet. And it's a similar thing for Airport. You're going to go into the network. You're going to select the Wi-Fi option. You're going to go into Advanced and click and then look for the Wi-Fi address and just note the number that is there. And then on iOS, you go into Settings, you go into General, you go into About and note the Wi-Fi address. So that is going to be the MAC address. And again, you're looking for this group of six numbers, two at a time, separated by numbers and digits, separated by colons, and that is the MAC address. So write those down, either the MAC address or the DHCP client ID, and then you're ready to set up the configuration in your router. Now, the instructions that I'm going to give you are for an Airport Extreme, but it should be fairly similar for any network router that you have. So just go into your network router's configuration. In the case of Airport, we're going to be using Airport utility, and you're going to set up these DHCP reservations. And when you're doing this, you're going to be dealing with what's called private IPs. And there's a couple different ranges of these. Personally, on my network, I use what's called the 10.0.0.0 range. There's also 192.168.0.0 and 172.16.0.0. Doesn't really matter which one you use. You just need to know which one you're using, because that's going to kind of be how you're going to deal with the setup. So in our case, we're going to open up Airport Utility. We're going to select our airport and click on the manual setup button and then go to the internet section. And then we're going to click on the DHCP tab and then check, you know, you can just check the settings on the DHCP range, address range that you're doing. This is really optional. I only do this because I like to leave part of the DHCP range open for static IP addresses. If I do want to have a few devices on my network that I actually manually assign IP addresses, because the way DHCP normally works is it's going to assign numbers in sequential order to devices that request IP addresses from it, ranging from 1 to 255 in the last number of the IP slot. So for example, if you're using the range 10.0.0.0 like I am, it's going to assign numbers from IP addresses from 10.0.0.1 to 10.0.0.255. In this little setting, you can actually stop the range or define a shorter range. So in mine, I have it set to go from 1 to 200, leaving 55 IP addresses open at the end of the range to use for manual IP address assignments. But again, this is something you don't necessarily have to do. While you're in here, you might also want to check out the DHCP lease time. If it's really short, this is something that can lead to this conflict problem, because what can happen is if a device, something goes wrong, a device to the network looks like it's not there, it might expire that IP address and then reassign it to another device. And then suddenly you come back, you wake up your Mac, it still has locally cached that IP address and it says, hey, this is my IP address. Meanwhile, the router has already assigned it to some other device on the network, and now there's that conflict going on. So one way to counteract that issue is to maybe lengthen this. So, you know, set it to a day or a couple days rather than an hour or just a few minutes. And that can get around some of the problems. I think you'd never want to assign a DHCP lease to a couple minutes. Well, maybe there are some scenarios where you'd want to do that. But typically, you're going to want to have it assigned, you know, for a fairly long amount of time, as long as stuff's not coming off and on your network very, very frequently. But you can look at that little setting there. But what we're really after is the DHCP reservations. So you'll see a section for DHCP reservation. And to add one, all you have to do is click the little plus button. Then in the description, enter anything you'd like to remember the reservation. So you might say, my MacBook Pro, Ethernet. And then you reserve it by choosing, hey, do I want to reserve by MAC address or DHCP client ID? And that just depends on what you decided to do earlier when we were talking about that. So then enter the, you know, so select the appropriate option, and then enter either the MAC address or that client ID. And then you set the desired IP address for that device. Now, preferably, you're going to do this in a range that is outside the already assigned DHCP addresses on your network, but still in that DHCP range that you looked at earlier. So again, in my case, that would be any number from 10.0.0.1 to 10.0.0.200. And once you've done that, you click done and you go on and you can do as many DHCP reservations as you'd like. In my case, I've done it for every device that is on my network, whether it's a Mac or it is a HomeKit hub or it's a Sonos device or anything that requests an IP address on my network actually has a DHCP reservation. And then once you've set them all up, you're going to reset your airport router. And when it comes back up, every device that you've matched a DHCP client ID or a MAC address with should get its reserved IP address. Now, you may need to also reset the device or go in and click renew DHCP lease to actually get the new IP address to get assigned. But from that point forward, that device should always get that assigned IP address anytime it connects to your network, and it's going to help avoid these network conflicts. And then, as mentioned earlier, the other cool thing is that any new device that's coming on the network still will go out, request an IP address from the DHCP server, and it'll be given something that is outside of these reservations. So, you know, if you've used from 10.0.0.1 to 10.0.0.15, and then a new device comes in on the network, the DHCP server is going to know, all right, I've already used 1 through 15 because those are reserved. I can give this one 16 or 17 or 18 and so on and so on and so on. So, you know, it's kind of a really cool trick. And doing this can also be helpful, I think, for troubleshooting your network, because now you know the exact address for any device that is specifically on your network. So if you see an IP address, you can go, hey, I know what that is. That is my iPhone or my wife's iPad, or that is the HomeKit hub or whatever thing might be my Nest thermostat. You know, who knows? It could be almost anything. And I'll give you one other cool little trick kind of related to this. When I set up my IP reservations, I did my numbering based on the type of device that was being connected. So on my home network, all iOS devices are in the .20 range. So they go .20, .21, 22, 23, 24, 25. My Macs are in the 40 range, so 40, 41, 42, 43. My home automation devices, so anything that is HomeKit related, is in the .50 range. And all of my Sonos devices are in the .70 range. So when I'm troubleshooting, I can look just by that number and go, oh, that's something that's, you know, in the HomeKit network, or, you know, it's a connected device that's not a Mac, it's not an iPad, or that's a Mac, that's an iPad. And it's been very, very helpful in troubleshooting my network. So hopefully that kind of explains DHCP reservations a little bit technical, but I think once you get in there and start poking around, it'll start to make sense, especially now that you've had this kind of little primer on it. And then finally for today, I have my thing of the moment for you. I think I've told you about Radtech and their sleeves before, specifically the ones for MacBooks and MacBook Pros. I've used these for a long time, but I'm excited now because they have them for the iPad Pro. And on the iPad Pro, they are just as awesome as they are on the MacBook Pro. They sent one out for me to try. I have it on my iPad Pro now, and I will never not have it on my iPad Pro. What the sleeve is, and it's S-L-E-E-V-Z, is how they spell it. It's this tight-fitting microfabric cover that slides over the entire device and protects it from scratches. So if you have them for the MacBook Pro, you close it, you know, close the clamshell, you pull it over the whole thing, and it completely protects the outside of the device. In the case of the iPad Pro, it's going to protect the screen and the back of the device from getting scratched up. I like it a lot because I like to throw my iPad Pro or my MacBook Pro into a computer bag. Oftentimes there's other things in there, maybe folders, papers, pens, pencils, who knows what might be in there. And it gives me the peace of mind knowing that those other items aren't going to put any scratches on my beautiful Apple product. And the cloth itself that this stuff is made out of is something called Optex Super 80. And I can tell you, it is super durable. It is really strong. It's tear-proof. I've had one on my MacBook Pro for years, and it looks as good as new. It also always seems to bounce back. It doesn't seem to get stretched out. It's always nice form-fitting, you know, even though you've been using it for years and years. And what's a nice bonus is that this Optex stuff is really a kind of a space-age microfiber cloth, and it's very soft and very safe to use for cleaning your device as well. So you can use it to wipe away the grease and the smudges. And because you're carrying it, because it's, you know, what you carry your device in, you always have it with you. I have other cleaning cloths and stuff like that, but I forget to throw them in my bag. I forget where they are. They get lost. This you're always going to have. So you just take it off, wipe down your device, no more smudgy fingerprints. And it doesn't add any bulk, you know, unlike some sort of case or some other thing. This is just a thin, lightweight cover. You slide it off. I often fold it up and use it for sort of cradling or just cushioning my iPhone when it's on the table. So it has the bonus of doing that. And with this Mac, with this iPad Pro one, I can slide it on with the little opening. The opening's kind of on the side, and leave the opening on the side where the smart connector on the iPad Pro is. So then I can still reattach my smart keyboard, close it up, and it's like a nice little clamshell. And the big bonus thing, when they sent me mine, I slid it on, and then I noticed it had this little cut on the back of it, and I thought, oh no, it's damaged. And then I noticed there was another cut about the same size just up on the other end of it. And then I realized, oh, these are there on purpose. And the reason they're there is because I can slide my Apple Pencil in the back, and now it holds my Apple Pencil, my smart keyboard, the iPad Pro all together, all in one thing, and they're all together. And so that's a nice little option that you can get on this. It comes in 6 different colors. They have gray, fuchsia, indigo, green, grape, and black. So you can customize it to the color that you like. And they are US $30.95. If you want to get the Apple Pencil slots, you add another buck and you get them in there. Seems a little bit expensive, but I'm telling you, for the quality of this thing, it is worth it. Every penny, and you are going to love it. You can find them at radtech.com, radtech.com. And like I said, I've used these things for years. I would not buy a MacBook Pro without one, and now I'm not going to buy another iPad without one of them either. And so check it out, radtech.com, the Radtech sleeves for iPad Pro. And with that, that is going to do it for this episode of the MacCast. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank all of my show sponsors: Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, Disc Label, also Text Expander Touch for iPhone and iPad, along with PDF Pen for iOS and PDF Pen Scan Plus. You can check out all of their great software and get more information and details at smilesoftware.com/MacCast. And Gazelle. Gazelle is the fast and simple way to sell your used gadgets. You can find out what your used iPhone, iPad, or other Apple products are worth at gazelle.com. And right now is a good time to go to Gazelle because maybe you want to pick up a new iPad or new iPhone after the event on Monday. Lock in your price at Gazelle, sell your old device, and get some cash to maybe fund that new purchase. So gazelle.com. And a big thank you to all of my sponsors for their support of the MacCast. Bandwidth for the MacCast is provided by CacheFly. You can check them out at cacheFly.com. And all advertising on the MacCast is handled by Backbeat Media. They are at backbeatmedia.com. If you have a question for me, a comment, a suggestion for a future episode of the MacCast, you can send me emails. You can also send me audio comments. Those go to maccast@gmail.com. You can also leave a voicemail on the listener hotline. That number is 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IAM-9. If you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you can find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. And while you're there, be sure to check out the forum at forum.maccast.com. And if you want to follow me on social media, you can check me out on Twitter, twitter.com/MacCast. You can check out the MacCast Facebook page over at facebook.com/TheMacCast. Or if you prefer Google Plus, you can check out our Google Plus community at google.com/PlusMacCast. And that's the plus symbol. But with that, that is going to do it for now. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.